Okay.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to tell you, you can radically and permanently change your relationship to food without ever counting calories, carbs, or fat grams, without ever going on a diet. How do you do that? By changing your relationship to yourself. It's not what you're eating that's the real problem, it is what's eating at you. And when we get to those root issues, things with food totally change for good. So if you want to join me today, if you want to talk to me about what's weighing on you, what's eating at you, give me a call. Let's talk. The number here at the studio is 818-602-4929. I would love to hear what's on your mind. So a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the food mood formula that I have developed, which I correlate certain types of foods with certain types of moods. So if you find yourself eating ice cream, for example, anything smooth or creamy, that is an indication that you need comfort. It's not about willpower, you know, don't try to not eat that ice cream. Recognize that you're turning to ice cream because that's your way of comforting yourself. When you find new ways of comforting yourself, soothing yourself, being there for yourself, you won't turn to ice cream anymore. The second category is crunchy foods. So crunchy, anything with a bite, that is correlated to anger. And a lot of people get a little worried about the idea of anger. They don't want to be seen as angry people. But here's the thing, anger, feeling anger does not make you an angry person. It makes you a person who's angry. Anger is not a bad attitude. Anger is not a character flaw. Anger is simply a reaction to a situation. Now, a psychologist who's studied anger, Deborah Cox, says there are four distinct ways in which women suppress angry feelings. She talks about women, but I think it applies to all humans. So keep that in mind. So first of all, they internalize their feelings, blaming themselves for whatever has happened. They often direct their feelings onto themselves instead of to the situation that's really upsetting them. I call this the boomerang effect. When people turn the emotions they feel towards other people or situations back on themselves. Another response is to externalize anger. What does that mean? It means allowing anger to build up until it's all too much. This is what she calls externalizing, leading to an explosion of anger, total rage, which is usually followed by guilt, reinforcing the idea that anger is bad and unacceptable. A third style of dealing with anger is called containment, which means people know they're angry, but they hold it in, hoping the feeling will pass. It doesn't. It doesn't. You can't let it go. And the last category of anger she calls segmentation, which means that anger is completely denied. You know, that I'm not angry. I know you just punched me in the face, but I have no feelings about that. That's segmentation, also known as denial. So according to Dr. Cox, women who deny feeling angry despite obvious provocation usually think that anger is a character flaw. Also, they've gotten so good at denying their emotions that often they don't even realize they're angry, except that they turn to food, and then they take all that anger that they've denied and they dump it on themselves. I can't believe I ate that, right? No one says that in a kind tone. They usually say it in an angry tone. Actually, that brings something else up, which is people think that anger is all just like this big explosion of feeling. Recently, a friend was telling me about a really just annoying and vexing experience she had at customer service. And I said, wow, I could really relate. I don't blame you for getting mad. She goes, oh, I wasn't mad. I wasn't mad. I was just frustrated, she tells me. So like my friend, a lot of people think of anger as this big, intense, you know, almost a violent feeling. They don't realize that annoyance, frustration, irritation are all forms of anger, just not as intense. So anger doesn't only refer to that huge explosion of anger. It's anything on the continuum. And all emotions exist on a continuum from benign to intense. When we deny our anger, we never learn to gauge it. And we never learn to recognize the varying degrees of anger we feel under different circumstances. And when that happens, anything that's upsetting feels like a 10. If we don't know, like, oh, I'm annoyed, that's like a 3 or a 2.5. If you don't realize, oh, I'm annoyed as opposed to enraged, everything feels big. Everything feels intense and too much. And then when it's too much, we may express it with food and then get angry at ourselves for eating chips. That's how it works. So not good. We can change this. You know what else is related to anger? Shame. Amy Schumer made a movie called I Feel Pretty. And in the beginning of the movie, there's this poignant scene in which she studies her reflection in a full-length mirror, and her face registers such acute shame and sadness as she looks at her body, which is encased in shapewear. So shame means you think there's something wrong with you or wrong with your basic character. And shame is often confused with humiliation or guilt. Guilt means there's something wrong with what you did. You should have done something or you should not have done something. So guilt applies to action or inaction. Shame is about yourself, your essential character, your person. So guilt is, oh, there's something wrong with what I did. I shouldn't have done that. Shame is, oh, there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. And when you feel that horrible sense of shame, you may get angry. And instead of yelling at someone else or talking to someone else or working it through, you get mad at yourself. So by recognizing the shame-anger connection and taking steps to change it, it will lose its power over you. Brené Brown, who is known for her research into vulnerability, describes shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Her research shows that the primary shame trigger for women is their physical appearance. For men, it's the fear of being perceived as weak. So if you can relate to these feelings, think about how you would respond to someone who felt terrible about her appearance. Would you shame her or him? Or would you offer your understanding and support? When you treat yourself as you would treat a friend, you will feel good about yourself without having to be perfect. I'm going to talk more about that later in the show. But basically, self-love is the ultimate antidote to shame. Keep in mind that nobody has a perfect body. Nobody has a perfect life. Nobody gets through life without making mistakes or doing dumb things. We have to normalize the fact that we are all perfectly imperfect. We are all perfectly imperfect. We have to appreciate our unique qualities instead of focusing on what we're not doing or what we're not enough of or what we're too much of. We all do things we later regret. We all do things that we don't like. We all have qualities about ourselves that maybe we don't like. But when we accept those qualities, when we are in a place of, you know what, on balance, I like myself. I don't like certain things, but I like myself overall, we'll be less angry at ourselves and more at peace. If you want to join the conversation, if any of this resonates with you, give me a call. The number here at the studio is 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. So what does turning on yourself look like? I get this question a lot. like, Dr. Nina, you talk about turning on yourself, turning against the self. What the heck do you mean by that? So I'm going to give you an example with someone I'm going to call Jane. So Jane comes in and she tells me that she is so out of control. She tells me the slightest thing makes her totally lose it. She said by the time she gets to work, she's already on edge because she's so out of control on the road. Well, if you guys live in LA or if you live in any city with traffic, I am sure you can relate to that. But for Jane, this was a particular trigger. I mean, one of the things that made her ballistic every single day was that every single day she waited in a long line to get on the freeway, like a couple of blocks long line, queue of cars. And invariably, someone would drive to the front of the line and cut in. Ugh! That happens to me all the time. I hate it too. But it absolutely enraged Jane. She said, I wish I could pull those drivers out of the car and punch them in the face. She was fuming. She was furious. And then she immediately looked horrified. Like, she said, she's like, see, look, I'm totally out of control. Why am I so out of control? She asked me. I said, well, did you actually pull a driver out of the car and punch them in the face? She's like, no, but I did eat a bag of corn chips when I got to work. So I explained that feeling out of control is not the same as losing control. It's only when people act on their rage that it becomes a problem. So wanting to punch someone is a lot different than actually doing it. So her response to that was, yeah, well, eating a whole bag of corn chips is definitely out of control behavior. Jane could not speak to these drivers. She couldn't give them a piece of her mind. She couldn't stop them from cutting in and not playing by the rules that everyone else was playing by. What she could do was chomp down on chips as a way of expressing that anger. Now, I wondered, why was Jane so intensely triggered by these rude drivers? Why? I mean, I think it bothers everybody, but it was beyond triggering to her. It was ruining her day before she even got to work. So why was that? So we started looking at that, and she remembered something that happened to her back in middle school. Jane had studied really hard for a history exam, and she did not do well. She got like a C minus or something. Yet the same day, she found out that her best friend had gotten A without studying. Why? Her best friend had cheated on the exam, and that's how she got the good grade. So this had been really a seminal incident for her, for Jane, when she realized, you know what, the world is not fair, and people get away with behaving badly. They do the wrong thing, and there's no justice. So people who did the right thing could be punished. People who did the wrong thing could just, you know, prevail. And this was deeply disturbing to her at the time. And so every time she sees a driver in present day trying to cheat by cutting in line, her sense of injustice is activated and she gets mad. And then she said, oh, and here's the turning on yourself again. She said, you know what really got her mad? She said the fact that she weighs more than she ever has weighed in her life. She is so mad at herself, as she put it, for letting herself go. That's turning on yourself. That's turning against yourself. Jane takes the anger she feels at these people who are perpetrating an injustice on the road, which activates all her other sense of injustice in her life. And rather than, yes, you people, you're doing the wrong thing, I'm mad at you, it becomes, you people, I'm mad at you. No, I'm really mad at myself. Oh my God, I can't believe what I ate. So Jane wanted to know what else she could do with her anger other than get mad at herself or eat corn chips. And she said that she tried to find another way to drive to work, but it this other way would give her, like, take an extra hour every morning. That was not acceptable. She tells herself that these drivers have nothing to do with her. She doesn't know them. She may never see them again. What does she care? That doesn't work either. And I told her she was trying to think away her feelings, and that doesn't work. The only way to get rid of feelings is to actually feel them. And that way, you don't turn to chips or any other kind of food to express your anger. And she said, well, I am feeling my emotions. Like I said, I get mad at those drivers. Jane was telling me that she was angry. And kind of the same way she would say, it's really warm today. I wish it would cool down. So she was identifying her emotional state, but she wasn't allowing herself to really express it, to really process it. So like Jane, many people believe that identifying what they feel is the same as actually feeling feelings. So identifying an emotion sounds neutral, as if you're stating a fact, kind of with indifference, like, I am so mad at those drivers. Versus, oh my God, I'm so upset at those drivers. They are driving me, driving me crazy. Right? One is kind of just a statement of fact. The other is, it's sort of the feeling of it gets expressed. And that's how you get rid of the feeling. So it is vital that you go beyond naming a feeling to actually expressing it. So feeling emotions requires intensity and conviction. You know, I am really upset versus I'm really upset. I'm really upset that's going on. It's the expression of the feelings, not the identification, but the expression of them that makes them go away. Now, we see this all the time in kids, right? They get upset, they get disappointed, they cry, or they have a tantrum, they have some kind of physical expression of how they feel. And when they're done, it's over. The storm has passed. Next. Now, I am not advocating that you cry and wail and carry on and have a tantrum. Don't beat your fists on the floor like a toddler. But I am saying it's critical to acknowledge, validate, and express your emotions. That means recognizing a situation has upset you and honoring that reaction. So, and by the way, there are times when you may actually confront a person who's upset you, but other times it's really a matter of acknowledging those feelings to yourself or with someone that you trust. Sometimes telling someone you're mad at them does not help. Like, you're not going to tell your boss, oh my God, I hate you for these five, reasons. That's not going to help. But you can tell your friend. You can tell yourself. So in Jane's case, three things had to happen. First, she had to acknowledge that she had a basic human right to feel angry. Second, she had to recognize the source of that intense anger and process what had happened in the past. The only way to keep the past out of the present is to deal with it fully so you don't get haunted by it. Things don't get reactivated. And finally, third, she had to learn to express that anger directly. Now, like many women and men, but mostly women, Jane was not comfortable feeling anger because she was brought up with the idea that nice girls don't get mad. If she would get mad, her mom would be like, that's not nice. That's not nice. Don't be mad. That's not nice. So why do so many women struggle with anger? Well, decades ago, women relied on their husbands financially for support, and they did not dare express anything that might get them kicked out of the marriage and the house. So instead, these women learned to stop anger in its tracks. They converted anger into silence or depression, which was easier and safer to show. It's showing depression is less threatening than showing anger. And this kind of stoicism was passed down from generation to generation. So many women in contemporary modern society learned to stifle their anger because they saw their mothers doing it, who saw their mothers doing it, who saw their mothers doing it, and on and on and on. But they don't know why. They just learned this is what you do. But if that anger is not recognized and expressed, it may be turned into depression, it may be denied, or it may be turned against yourself into displacement. So instead of allowing themselves to express how they felt, they turned against themselves and would get mad at themselves for their weight or for what they ate, like Jane. So clearly, Jane had to get to the bottom of what was eating at her. And as we were talking about this, We talked about how injustice and unfairness were real triggers for her. She had another thought, kind of an epiphany, actually, about why she got so mad at these drivers. So as a child, it seemed to Jane that her parents favored her brother. He had privileges that they denied to her because she was a girl. He got a later curfew. He got his driver's license at a younger age. He got, it seemed to Jane, whatever he wanted. And it was not fair. And she felt the same unfairness with the drivers who cut in front of her. So this anger at the drivers echoed the earlier anger, not just about her friend in middle school, but also about with her family growing up with her brother. That had never been processed. So Jane had to give anger a voice, because if you don't let yourself speak your anger again, you may just take it out on yourself instead. It's a lot easier to get mad at yourself for what you ate or what you weigh than it is to feel the feeling that you don't want to feel. But ultimately, that's the only thing that will liberate yourself. So here's what Jane had to say to me. She said, okay. She realizes she's mad at the drivers because it reminds her of earlier times in her life. She realizes she's also mad at her parents for favoring her brother and making her feel so upset and helpless. But she said, what do I do about that? Do I have to tell them how I feel? This is all stuff from the past, she said. I don't know what good it will do to talk about it now. They're old. I don't want to hurt them. And no, she should not talk to them about what happened in the past. Talking to people who hurt you in the past may sometimes be an option, but not always. Often, it is absolutely a waste of time and energy to tell someone you're upset at them because of something that happened 20 years ago or something that happened last week. Sometimes the person you're mad at is someone you can't actually talk to, like your boss, or maybe you're mad at someone who's passed away. Just because you cannot express yourself to that person doesn't mean you can't express your emotions. You can share your feelings with another person who understands, like a spouse, a best friend, a therapist. You can write out your feelings in a journal, which can be very therapeutic. Writing helps you express and release those feelings so you don't express them by grabbing a bag of chips. So a few weeks later, Jane came to her session in a good mood, and she was carrying a leather journal, a red leather journal. This was her anger journal, red for anger. Instead of eating chips, Jane had started writing about the drivers on the freeway. She started writing about her feelings towards her parents and towards her brother. She felt much better because she was getting it out onto the page, and she had not binged in the week since our previous session. So if you regularly get mad at yourself for what you eat or what you weigh, ask yourself, if I were not angry with myself, who or what would be making me mad? Very, very, very important question. So how do you express anger? Right, you can journal about it like Jane, but you could phone a friend about it. You can write it in a journal. You can physically express it in like a kickboxing class or something like that. I talked to my colleague and friend, Anita Avadian. She's an anger management expert and the author of Anger Management Essentials. And she says we need to find both long-term and short-term solutions to anger. She recommends learning to communicate assertively instead of passively. Many of us don't speak up, and then we get mad, we get resentful when other people don't understand how we feel, don't know how to meet our needs. So let other people know about your needs, your requests, your wants, your feelings. If you don't speak up, she points out, nobody else will know what's bothering you. She also recommends I statements. So one way of communicating effectively is using I statements. So instead of saying, you don't listen to me, you never listen to me, that's not an I statement. An I statement is, I feel discounted when you don't respond to me. So address the specific behavior rather than make a generalization. For example, you might say, you know, I feel hurt that you don't help me wash the dishes after dinner. Or it would make me so happy if you could pick up the kids every Thursday instead of, you know what, you are so lazy, you never help out. Yeah, that's not going to help. Another way of diffusing anger as opposed to expressing it is getting some vigorous physical exercise. Because when we exercise, first of all, endorphins are released. Alternately, doing something relaxing like yoga or meditation can also be helpful. But the physical expression of vigorous exercise can be very satisfying in that it helps like get rid of the pent-up physical feeling of anger. When, again, it's not processing the emotion, but it's getting the physical sensation out. And sometimes when your body is calmer and not so revved up, you're more able to process the feeling. Also, making a gauge. Gauging the intensity of your anger is so important. Like I said before, you know, annoyed might be a 2, irritated might be a 5, angry might be an 8, enraged is a 10. But if you don't have that gauge, everything feels like a 10. So Anita Avedian says, ask yourself how relevant your anger is given the situation. She points out, if your anger is a 9 out of 10 because your coworkers didn't invite you to lunch, then how angry will you be if your boyfriend cheats on you? So always remember that your anger and all feelings deserves your attention, not your condemnation. Again, I want to invite anyone out there who's listening to call in and share your thoughts about anger or anything else that's on your mind. The number here at the studio is 818-602-4929, 818-602-4929. So I have a question from Chris from Torrance, California. He or she, hard to know which, given that that name could be either. Chris asks, of all the things you recommend, what do you think is the most helpful and important? Well, Chris, I think the most important step you can take to change your relationship to food is to turn your inner critic into a friend. I find that so many of us are really loving and understanding and supportive of other people. But when it comes to ourselves, it is a whole different story. I like to say that if you wouldn't say it to a child, a friend, or someone you love, don't say it to yourself. Example, so I have a support group once a week, and I've had situations in my support group where someone will talk about, you know, eating a whole pizza and how bad they felt about themselves afterwards, or a pint of ice cream. And everyone chimes in like, oh no, don't feel bad. You know, something was going on with you. There's a reason. If you're turning to a pizza or ice cream, you're turning away from something else, which is another one of my favorite things I like to tell people. What's going on with you? What's happening? They're so compassionate. They want to understand. They want to look what's eating at you. And then it's their turn to share. And they say things like, I am so disgusting. I can't believe I have zero self-control. I hate myself. If they just talk to themselves the way they talk to other people, they would feel better. Often we use food to get away from our own critical voice. And if you talk to yourself in a kind way on a regular basis, you're able to comfort yourself with words and not use food for that purpose. Comfort words, comfort language, not comfort food. Remember, thoughts lead to emotions, which lead to behavior. If you're thinking, oh, I'm so disgusting, or I just can't handle this feeling, I just can't handle it, then you're going to feel bad, and you're going to head straight for the fridge or the pantry or the drive-thru or something. But if you think, okay, I'm struggling right now, but I can get through this. This is painful. I recognize that this is hard. I'm going through something difficult. But I'm gonna get through it. I'm not always gonna feel this way. What do I need right now to help myself? Then you know what? You're gonna feel better. And when you feel better because you're being a friend to yourself, not a critical, judgmental, horrid, mean girl or a mean guy, then you won't need food. You won't need to eat for comfort or distraction. You're already comforting and reassuring yourself with words. So here's a quote from a book called How to Be Your Own Best Friend. The authors are psychologists Mildred Newman and Bernard Berkowitz. They remind us we can learn to be our own best friend. If we do, we have a friend for life. We can build ourselves up, give ourselves comfort and sustenance in the times when there is no one else. Kind of beautiful, isn't it? So as the folks on the website Loner Wolf remind us, every great sage, guru, and spiritual master has pointed to a great life-shattering truth. Other people, including your wife, your husband, your partner, your friends, your parents, your siblings, your daughter, your son, your grandchild, your grandchildren, anybody else, nobody else will make you happy and whole. Nobody or nothing else will make you feel happy and whole. Never, ever. Your occupation, retirement, hobbies, dreams, aspirations, and socioeconomic status will also never make you complete. Why? You probably already know the answer, but I will say it anyway. Without first learning how to enjoy, appreciate, and respect ourselves, we will never be able to enjoy, appreciate, and respect the other people and things in our lives, and we will never be able to receive their respect and love. So, you know, it's tough, and the writers say if we fail to put in the painful and strenuous effort of making peace with our hypocritical, deceptive, weak, and sickly selves towards the cultivation of self-love and understanding, we will forever be like everyone else in society, running around like headless chickens trying to gain love, acceptance, and validation in an endless, futile cycle of chaos, confusion, disappointment, and perpetual emptiness. They say if you want to stop wasting your life seeking something you wanted and had all along, think Wizard of Oz. You need to wake up. You need to realize that becoming your own best friend is not simply a bunch of fluffy, feel-good self-improvement talk, but an actual life and death matter. Sounds a tad drastic and dramatic. It is. It is. Because without taking charge of your life and becoming your own best friend, you will continue to feel the pain of rejection, the pain of loneliness, the pain of shame, the pain of self-disgust, the pain of abandonment. By the way, turning to food instead of comfort yourself is self-abandonment. You will continue to unconsciously or consciously believe yourself to be unworthy and unlovable. After all, how can you love another person wholly and truly without first learning to love and accept yourself? Learning how to become your own best friend is an excellent start. So here are 12 ways to be your own best friend. The longest relationship you will ever have in the history of your life is with yourself. Therefore, it's up to you to cultivate the strength and depth of the connection you have with yourself. It may not be easy, but again, it will be life-changing. Nothing worth it is ever easy. If it were easy, it wouldn't be as satisfying. If it's easy, it just doesn't resonate as much. So don't be afraid of hard work. You've probably been through difficult things in your life. You can do this. It is difficult, but you know what else is really difficult? Spending the rest of your life feeling bad about yourself because of the number on the scale, or because you ate a muffin and had 30 grams of fat. That's hard. That's hard to live that way. So we want to liberate you from that and give you a new way of being in the world. When you decide to take care of yourself, to take charge of yourself, there's still a big job ahead. It takes thought and effort to shake free of bad habits, and it is a habit to be mean to yourself. A part of you might even be kind of indignant at the changes that you're trying to make. That's the part of you that's comfortable in the old ways, the part of you that has no interest in seeing things differently or doing things differently. That part can put up quite a fight. Because, you know, we cling to what is most comfortable to us, even if that means perpetuating our own self-destructive cycles of misery and pain. Be aware of this. You must possess courage, determination, willpower, and persistence in order to break old habits and establish new ones. Even something so simple as admitting you've made a mistake in the way you've treated yourself can be difficult. But as the writers of the book comment, they say it's an awful blow to the ego to feel you've made a mistake. That's why people don't want to change. It would mean admitting they were wrong. So even though the list of 12 ways to be your own best friend may seem common sense and straightforward, it really isn't. If you decide to go with all of them or some of them, the best way to go about it is not to fight or resist, but to accept. It's normal to feel a little weird. It's normal to feel a little unsettled or uncomfortable when you're establishing new thoughts, mindsets, and behaviors. If you've ever done anything like go to the gym, when you first go to the gym, it's kind of awkward, right? You're like, what are those machines? And you sit down and it feels weird and you're like, okay, how do I do this? And you start doing it and it feels painful and awkward and you've got to think about it all the time. And it's not easy, but if you go to the gym on a regular basis, one day you find yourself without even realizing it, you sit down, you sit in the whatever piece of equipment and you're just doing whatever, you're doing whatever this is. you're doing this and you're not even thinking about it. Maybe you're even having a conversation with some new friend you met at the gym. So that's how you get a new habit. At first, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable, it's painful, it feels weird. But in time, it becomes the new normal. Okay, now I'm finally getting to the 12 ways of becoming your own best friend. Number one, praise yourself rather than wait for others to do it. When you do something you're proud of, dwell on it a little. It's not being boastful, it's being proud, and you earned it. Praise yourself for it. Relish the experience. Take it in. So many people say, oh, I can't say that that's boastful, that's selfish. I can't do that. Yes, you can. If you do something well, own it. Enjoy it. Love it. You'd probably do that to your friends all the time. Like, well done. Good job. I'm so proud of you. Why can't you say the same of yourself? Right? Number two, recognize that you are fundamentally worthy. Most of us equate failures in our lives with being a failure. Right? It's not that we fail to do something, it's that we are failures in life. We need to remember that if we outsource our self-worth and self-esteem, we will always wind up feeling like miserable failures because the thoughts, opinions, beliefs, and expectations that we use as yardsticks to measure our success and worth are outside our control. They constantly fluctuate and change and often cause us to feel like failures because we never cultivated an inner and innate sense of worthiness. So that sense of self-worth has to come not from what you're doing, not from what you're accomplishing, not from what you're eating. Don't be proud because you ate clean. That is not an accomplishment. Be proud because you're a loving person, you have tenacity, you're kind. That's something to be proud of. Feel good about who you are, not the number on the scale or some made-up goal. You know, don't be proud of yourself because of something you didn't do. Like, oh, I'm so proud of myself, I didn't eat that pizza. No, no. Don't be proud of yourself for that. Be proud of who you are. You are a fundamentally worthy person. Number three, laugh at yourself. Not in a mocking or self-derisive way, but laugh like a friend would. Like, giggle about things that you do that are silly. Be good-natured towards yourself. Find humor in the little strange things you think and say and do. Be delighted with yourself. When you stop taking yourself so seriously, or, you know, I think I wouldn't put it taking yourself so seriously. When you stop having a microscope on all your perceived deficits, when you kind of lighten up and open up, you also open yourself up to more inner harmony and wholeness. You know, just so be more delighted with yourself. Laugh with yourself. Number four, accept rather than punish yourself. Does a good friend punish you with an onslaught of criticism for hours? No. Do you punish yourself with an onslaught of criticism for hours? Maybe. So a true friend accepts both the good and the bad in you without passing judgment. They realize no one is perfect. Everyone has some kind of hidden thing they don't like about themselves, some kind of, you know, internal, not so imperfect self, whether large or small within them. Not only is acceptance a healthier option, but it also opens doorways that allow you to solve your problems. You can't solve anything when you're berating yourself and getting mad at yourself. So accept yourself. Say, okay, you know what? I don't like the fact that I blow up at my kids, you know, too easily, but I'm working on it. I'm working on it. I own it. And I'm gonna take steps to change rather than I'm such a terrible person because I yelled at my kids. Number five, spend a lot of time discovering more about your character and personality. What are your deepest drives and motivations? What things do you like and dislike? What are your greatest strengths and weaknesses? Oftentimes, people look outside of themselves for the formulation of their tastes, ideas, goals, and pursuits because they haven't spent enough time developing a strong sense of self. Or they think they have to be like other people are, like their parents were, or their siblings, or their friends. The more you understand yourself truly, the easier it will be to like and respect yourself for who you are rather than what you think you are according to other people, according to trends, circumstances in your life. That's what psychoanalysis is all about. It's discovering who you are. It's freeing the statue from the stone, as Michelangelo said. It's not changing and becoming someone else. It's finding out who your truest self is. And that is incredibly powerful. Number six, cultivate self-awareness. Now, this is similar to the last point, but it differs in that it doesn't necessarily involve becoming conscious of your personality, but really your inner workings, your thoughts, your feelings, your beliefs, your assumptions, your motivations. So paying attention to what goes on inside you. There's a word in psychoanalysis or psychology called mentalizing. And that is a word that it means thinking about how you think. But being able to sort of have an objective view of the way that you think about yourself and the world. So paying attention to what goes on inside of you is the first step to discovering why you think, feel, and behave the way you do. And that leads to self-understanding. That's an essential ingredient in any healthy friendship and relationship, including the relationship between you and you. Without being aware of who you are and why you think as you do and what you want and what you don't want, you'll never be able to develop a genuine bond with yourself. Number seven, seek out solitude. In order to develop a good level of awareness and understanding of yourself, you need time alone, away from distractions and dramas of the world. That means no devices, no technology. You gotta learn how to be with yourself, and solitude is essential in developing that good, healthy, strong bond with yourself. If you can't stand being by yourself, if you can't enjoy your own company, you're never gonna be able to be your own best friend. So here's the deal. Loneliness is being alone with no interest, no compassion, it's being alone with your critic, right? That's a horrible feeling, and that's why often people have a hard time being alone. Solitude is when you are alone with a kind, understanding, supportive part of yourself that can be there for you and with you. Number 8, learn how to support and comfort yourself. A genuine best friend is supportive and comforting in times of need and distress, often knowing exactly what to say or what to do to make us feel better. When it comes to supporting ourselves, on the other hand, like the people in my support group, we often drown out our pain by eating or other self-destructive behaviors. Last week, my guest, Kelly Gunter, shared how she lost 243 pounds with bariatric surgery. And to her astonishment, she did not gain happiness, self-esteem, and a sense of well-being when she lost all that weight. She felt the same. She found herself gambling instead. She turned to other self-destructive measures. She ultimately had to figure out why she was turning to food, which she did. She became her own best friend. And I highly recommend her memoir about her experience called You Have Such a Pretty Face. And if you haven't listened to that episode, I highly recommend that too. You will be inspired. So learning how to face our hurt instead of escaping it is one of the most essential and most difficult ways of developing self-love. When we listen to our emotional needs and open ourselves up to the vulnerability of experiencing shame, anger, grief, we can then learn how to assuage that hurt. We can learn how to respond to ourselves. We can learn how to make ourselves better in a healthy and productive way. We can be a friend to ourselves, right? Number 9, how are we doing on time? Whoop. I might have to finish this next week. Learn how to have fun alone. When most of us think of enjoying ourselves, we usually equate it with other human contact. Going to the movies, playing sports, attending meetups, having dinner with friends at restaurants. It's a sad truth that many of us have learned to enjoy life only in the company of others, but not solely in the company of ourselves. So try developing an enjoyable interest that you can pursue alone. Doing so will help to deepen your bond with yourself. Personally, I, as some of you may know, I take figure skating lessons. I am a horrible figure skater. I'm out there on the ice, like, I don't know, just trying not to fall on my tush while these like little, you know, 5-year-olds are racing around and doing axles and jumping 10 feet in the air. And but you know what? It's just such a great, peaceful, wonderful feeling to be on the ice. I'm not with them. We're all by ourselves. I'm on the ice practicing and just enjoying the experience. So find something you love. And it doesn't have to be exercise related, but find something that you love that you can do alone. I'm going to save the next 2 recommendations for how to be your own best friend for next week, because we are out of time. So thank you for joining me today on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. I am so glad to spend this hour with you. If you'd like more food for thought, check out my website, winthedietwar.com, and follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Dr. Nina Inc. See you next week.